future. There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Yes, everybody, welcome. Once again, it is Friday, April 9th, 2021. We are back for our weekly news roundup. This is Kevin Mahoney, Raging Chicken. Yes, this is Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. Yes, I am the editor and founder of Raging Chicken. And each week I talk to the vaccinated shit poster himself, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Yes, we are streaming live on our YouTube channel, right? Hello to everybody on our YouTube channel right now. And if you are listening to this on the podcast, well, make sure you head on over to our YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe to it. Make sure you like the stream. And hit that little bell. So every time that we go live, you get that notification and you can join the conversation live. Yes and yes. And, you know, the more you smash that subscribe button, the more people get to see what's going on. And we hit a little bit of a milestone here. Now, again, we've only been really plugging our live stream for, you know, not too long, a couple months now. And we just crossed the 100 subscriber threshold. So thank you to all of you who've subscribed. Please share it with your friends, kind of get kind of news out about this. It is having a kind of significant measurable impact upon the reach of our podcast. So if you want to hear progressive voices from right here in our backyard, from across the country, reach more people, more ears, and build out that network, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Subscribe to our podcast. Make sure you leave the review. And if you're over on that YouTube channel, make sure you like the stream and you hit that bell so you're notified every time that we go live. This week's show, man, so much is going on. U.S. intelligence officials released their global trends report, and it's pretty bleak. As the Washington Post headline reads, intelligence forecast sees a post-coronavirus world upended by climate change and splintering societies. It's like throwing a bunch of cold water on the fields right now. On the other news, Biden's infrastructure plan is pretty freaking awesome. We haven't had a chance to talk about that. In a new study by the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, it found that most of the January insurrectionists came from counties with the most significant declines in the non-Hispanic white population. That is, it didn't come from the deep red counties like the Trump country. No, it came places like Bucks County. Yeah, that's right. Bucks County, PA, that sent the most number of people from Pennsylvania to that insurrection. Pretty crazy, right? So any place that seems to be a counties that experiencing significant shift in demographics are the ones who sent them to this, to the insurrection. The study also found that those involved in the insurrection are older and more professional than right-wing groups studied in the past. They were all, however, you guessed it, 95% white and 85% male. The lead researcher, political scientist Robert Pate, suggests that 90% of the insurrectionists are still in the process of congealing into a mass movement and that is willing to put violence at its core. Heads up. Senate parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough helped pave the way for Democrats to use budget reconciliation again this fiscal year to pass Biden's proposed $2 trillion infrastructure plan. She said that the Section 304 of the Congressional Budget Act of 1974 allows the Senate to use reconciliation more than once in a fiscal year because it says the two houses may adopt a concurrent resolution on the budget which revises or affirms the concurrent resolution on the budget for such fiscal year most recently agreed to. Basically what that means, yes, the Democrats get another shot to use this, not once, but two more times at least. But just to balance that equation, apparently, Joe Manchin flip-flops, saying now that there's no way that he would vote to get rid of or weaken the filibuster. At the same time, pushing back on using reconciliation. What the hell's up with this dude? Biden's new Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, calls for a single minimum global corporate tax. Yep, she said enough of this 30-year race to the bottom. Time to even the playing field. Biden announced on Thursday moves to end gun maker liability protections as part of a series of executive actions in response to gun violence. And things just get worse and worse for Trump-loving and all-around creepy Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz. New York Times reported that Gates went pardon shopping in the final weeks of Trump's term. Apparently, he asked Trump for an unconditional pardon for any crimes that he may or may not have committed. And it looks like his good pal, the one that was also kind of hiring underage girls to go out and party, maybe just flipping on Gates. So this will be interesting. And one out of every three UK teachers plans to quit in the next 5 years. Why? Well, because the rapidly increasing workload and growing disrespect for teachers. And that's according to the results of a survey by the National Education Union, and then when they asked their 10,000 members. So one wonders what would happen if U.S. teachers began thinking along the same lines. Today's a little close to home here in Pennsylvania. Congratulations to Kadita Kenner from the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center and We the People. She's accepted a new role as the executive director of the New Pennsylvania Project. Kadita will be fighting to protecting voting rights right here in Pennsylvania as Republicans continue to push Trump's big lie in 2020 and ramp up their nationwide attacks on voting rights. Speaking of the attacks on voting rights in Pennsylvania by Pennsylvania Republicans, Republicans Daryl, yes, our good friend Daryl Metcalf, Seth Grove, Chris Dush, and dozens other conservative Republicans were spotted having dinner with Kris Kobach Tuesday evening. Yes, Kobach was the Secretary of State in Kansas and helped weaponize Trump's unfounded election fraud claims in 2016. Kobach is basically who's led point on voter suppression efforts in the Republican Party. Now, if that's not bad enough, Seth Grove is wrapping up his show hearings on the 2020 elections and has started inviting Coke-aligned front groups. I don't mean the Coca-Cola group, who's not in fashion in Republican circles there. No, but we're talking about the Koch brother guys. Koch brothers aligned front groups to push their anti-voter agenda in the latest House State Government Committee hearings. Grove had members from the Foundation of Government Accountability and the Heritage Foundation's Honest Elections Project speak at his most recent hearings. And in their 2021 Gerrymandering Threat Index, Represent.us has moved Pennsylvania into the moderate risk category as PA Republicans gear up their voting repression machine. Get ready, Pennsylvania, because the push to restrict rights at the ballot box is coming our way. And Representative Scott Perry struggles with using Venn diagrams. And did you know if you offer people a discount to shop at your store, you just might be part of the plan of microchip lizard men to eat your liberties? It could happen. Well, that is kind of did happen to Donna Gouldry, owner of Allura Gifts and Home Decor in Doylestown, PA. The crazy story is highlighted in Cyril Michalako's latest column, Hysterical Social Media Mob Targets Doylestown Businesswoman. And we'll get into that. And I welcome Cyril on Out to Coop Live this past Monday. Fantastic conversation. He's going to be on the show quite a bit in the future. I'm very much looking forward to that. And COVID cases and hospitalizations continue to rise in PA and New Jersey, even as vaccines roll out. And I just heard this last night, too, as well, that now COVID is one of those variants. I think it's the UK variant is now the dominant strain in the U.S. And the University of Pittsburgh has ordered students to shelter in place as coronavirus cases spike again. And I should also mention that, turns out that despite everything that Chancellor Greenstein is saying about PASHE's, like students and faculty loving the idea about consolidation and mergers, well, didn't turn out so much. Yes, the union just released a survey showing that kind of upwards of 80% of the faculty involved in those mergers are not happy about it and do not think it's a good idea. Students, likewise, not fans. We'll get into that. And in today's segment three, our last call, space news and beer news, we got NASA's Ingenuity helicopter survived its first several days detached from the Perseverance rover. Yesterday, the little helicopter unlocked its rotors and will go through a series of tests before attempting the first ever powered flight on the red planet. Sometimes after this Sunday, April 11th. And it's official. Yes, I'm signed up for the 2021 Mars Society Virtual Convention. Yes, Raging Chicken will be attending this year's Mars Society Convention from October 14th through 17th. Maybe Elon Musk will be a key speaker again this year. Mars Society Virtual Convention brings together prominent scientists, policymakers, entrepreneurs, space advocates to discuss the significance of the latest scientific discoveries, technological advances, and political, economic, social developments that could affect plans for human exploration and settlement of Mars. Those are their words, their description. Yes, the Mars Society was founded in 1998 by Robert Zubrin, who motherboard writer Abraham Reisman calls the right-wing Mars guru. We are going down that rabbit hole. And I want to remind you to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org and also tune in to the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And make sure to subscribe to the Rick Smith Show's daily podcast on iTunes, Podbeans, wherever you get your podcast. And if you haven't already, you must check out the newly launched Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. You can find it on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcast. The first episode dropped last week, and they are recording episode number 2 with a mystery guest this Sunday. So that'll be out this coming week. Yes, do check it out. First episode dropped last week, and an amazing PA women steering the cauldron behind the podcast Rock the House. I loved it. I was so excited about this. Not only do they kind of like know politics in the PA, they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Be sure to follow them on Twitter, too, at The Night Caucus, and make sure you subscribe to their podcast, Sisters of the Night Podcast. On Out to Coop Live this coming Monday, this past Monday, thanks again to Cyril Michaleko for joining me. He is the progressive columnist for the Intelligencer and the Bucks County Courier Times. He has been just kind of busting it out. We talked a little bit about the infiltration of the Turning Point USA folks into the Pembridge School District. We talked about progressive movements in Bucks County and across the state of Pennsylvania, and talked about Directed Way to Go and what his column was all about. So he's going to be back on the show kind of quite a bit. I'm very, very much looking forward to it. As you hear, his second column just dropped today, talking about what's going on in Doylestown with this kind of crazy situation of this shopkeepers being harassed by the nut job conspiracy freaks. This coming Monday, the plan is, at least, I'm just kind of double checking to make sure that this is square to go. But the plan is this coming Monday at 7 p.m. Out to Coop Live, we're going to have Chad Nicholson. Chad Nicholson is the Pennsylvania community organizer for the Community Environmental Defense Fund. And we're going to be talking about stuff that's been kind of going on in his legal work and organizational work around home rule charters. It's really kind of interesting. It's a little bit kind of focused. I'll warn you ahead of time. We're going to get into some of the kind of the legal parts of this case. You're seeing this happening up in, say, Grant Township. He's done some really interesting kind of work right here. I was trying to see if I can give you something quick. But about trying to find ways of basically using home rule charters and using kind of local democracy initiatives, right, and fighting the legal cases to prevent kind of like extractivism, fracking, and basically the destruction of the environment that is polluting people's wells and wrecking people's homes because of the kind of the explosion of fracking and extractivism through the state of Pennsylvania and kind of throughout the country. So should be a really interesting conversation. It's a fascinating story when we talked about it, and hope that's all go for Monday at 7 p.m. Very, very cool. And for all you gamers out there, please check out The Game Inn. That is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, happen to be the parents of one of my son's best friends. They've got everything that you'd want, all kind of old school stuff, new school stuff. They've got action figures, Funko Pops right across the board. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn. Check out their Facebook page at The Game Inn. That's with two N's, The Game Inn. Email them at thegameinpa@gmail.com or check out their website at The Game Inn, again with two N's, thegameinn.com. And seriously, if you're looking for something, I'll let them know. If you got kids, every A they get on the report card, they get a discount. Do check them out. And look, if we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. Support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today by becoming a patron of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. Look, we got rid of Trump. Now the hard work of building progressive future begins. We're here for the fight, and we need you. Become a patron for the price of a good beer once a month. Help keep the media in the movement in the media. Become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Now go to patreon.com/rcpress today. Sean, man, that was a mouthful. Sorry, man. How you doing?
Is everything going?
You're still breaking up a little bit. Hopefully that's not gonna continue. Things are going okay. Are you there?
I'm here. I know my connection's kind of unstable with my computer right now, so hopefully we'll be able to get through this.
maybe it's all the police that are coming for you right now.
Yeah, I think my neighbor's about to get. There's an apartment on my block that's about to get raided for the second time, I think, in the past several months. I've been rubbernecking outside my window this whole time. It feels good to be back, though. How was your Easter?
It was good. You know, it was kind of pretty much low key. We took kind of like a break, and that was really good. We got what was supposed to be just kind of like a little bit of a kind of a getaway, like, you know, basically go quarantine someplace else kind of thing. Turned out to be a little bit of some in part very relaxing on the one hand, a little bit of a headache on the other. We're supposed to have internet access and did not. So my kids' schooling and stuff was a little crazy. My youngest, my daughter, has to go back to full-time school next week because they got rid of the hybrid option. I've had been back and forth with PSSA people all week, you know, so it's like, it's been like, it was really relaxing. And then I came back this week and it was like just a mess of things they have to deal with. So I need to just be out digging in the dirt more is basically what it means. But other than that, how was your Easter?
Pretty good. We went to a Brazilian steakhouse. Kind of rolled the dice with everything. I got my first COVID scene a little over a week. I gained a new MacBook. So.
Oh, very good. You're breaking up your pretty bad.
Waiting for that to come in, and hopefully by next week we'll be able to.
Yeah, do me a favor. You're breaking up pretty bad. Can you just get out of the Zoom call and join the Zoom call once again?
Yeah. Let me do it right.
All right, everybody. We're gonna take a quick break and see if we can get this taken care of. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Sorry about that. I think we got it. Sean's actually just going to call in on his phone here. It was like the internet was not cooperating. So Sean, though, the question was, how was your Easter?
It was pretty good. Just give me one second. I'm plugging my phone into its charger so it does not die during this.
That'd be a plus.
Yeah. No, it's going pretty good. I think it's not my internet. I think it's my computer that's messed up. You know, my computer's on its last legs. So, I ponied up and I bought a MacBook last week, waiting for that to come in. Looking forward to that. I got my first vaccine shot and had Easter with my family. We went to Nebraza, which is a Brazilian steakhouse out in Horsham, near where my parents live. We kind of rolled the dice on that. it was worth it. I had to help foot a $200 bar bill.
I liked your question. Is this what adulting feels like?
My parents paid for dinner and, you know, they want us to split the drinks for everyone. So we did that. Was able to try whiskey I normally wouldn't have. Tried some Arbeg, which is a smoky scotch.
Uh-huh.
Going out of my comfort zone, it was pretty good. Definitely like that. And no, I mean, like, was just having fun with my camera and getting pictures of everyone, my niece and nephew enjoying Easter and the Easter egg hunt and stuff like that, you know, so it was fun.
Nice. Nice. Love to hear it.
I also got some awesome photos of the Capitol in bloom this week.
Oh, I'll say, man, those were fantastic.
Yeah. It's actually pretty funny because once I put my photos up, all the Harrisburg photographers went out the following day and started putting up their photos.
Nice.
So I got up nice and early for that. Wanted to get photos of the magnolia trees and like the daffodils that are blooming right now. So it was pretty good.
Nice. Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I mean, God, it's like, I mean, so much has happened over the past couple of weeks. And obviously there's no way we could possibly get to all of this, get all everything that's, you know, in some kind of coverage model of what's actually happened over the past couple of weeks. But there does seem to be some kind of things that have been pretty significant, what's going on. I mean, maybe we could just talk a little bit about, we could start with, well, I guess I want to pair these things to think about, because, you know, up front, I kind of put up this, you know, this new global trends report that came out from, you know, this kind of intelligent U.S. intelligence officials, that they put out this report every year. It's not a government report. It's a bunch of kind of like, you know, kind of U.S. intelligence experts, you know, people who were, and they put it out every year. It's supposed to have been to help kind of guide and kind of identify different threats. And, you know, they've been harping on, you know, for years, they've been talking about how, you know, unless climate change is being addressed, it's going to cause, that is going to be one of their number one concerns about what that's going to, you know, what that's going to, well, the challenges it's going to pose. But now they're saying after COVID, COVID just basically worsened things, right? And unless we kind of address things like inequality and climate change in a really robust way, they're seeing that that's actually going to be, you know, major, major issue. So you've got that on one hand, and that's paired also with what we see with Biden's infrastructure bill, which, of course, you know, he came out to, you know, came out to Pittsburgh in order to kind of announce that, which is, in my mind, kind of pretty, it's a pretty amazing initiative. I don't think it's big enough, but it's still, nonetheless, it's pretty amazing. And then following that, we get Joe Manchin coming out basically saying he's not going to touch the filibuster, and he's backpedaling to say he's not going to pass an infrastructure bill on through reconciliation. I mean, what the hell is going on, man? You know, what is this?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know, like, what's up with Manchin. Like, is he just doing this for branding exercises? Or does he really want to be the death nail to the democracy and the Democratic Party? I mean, I think like that's what he has to be like. It has to be conveyed to him. Do you want to be the person that's the sole responsible person, like, for the death of our democratic institutions because you wanted to protect the filibuster?
Yeah, it doesn't even make sense to me. It doesn't even make sense. What I mean, look, Manchin, you know, Manchin is.
I mean, like, we're.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, like, we're. I like what Raphael Warnock said. I don't think we were able to talk about this last time, but, like, pretty much, like, when he had an awesome quote saying we should start asking Republicans why they want to go after voting rights instead of asking us about the filibuster.
Exactly. Right.
And but he also said, like, why are we protecting minority rule in the Senate while Republicans are going after minority voters in the country?
I mean, there you have it.
Yeah. No, I mean, and it's also like, it's, you know, it's insane to see that. Like, it's just, it's bullshit. Like, and no, I mean, I think he'll eventually come around, but I could also see him being a person that flips caucuses. Like, you know what I mean? If this keeps it up.
Well, I mean, I think that's the kind of, you know, look, I mean, and frankly, I don't, you know, I don't know anything about the guy's psychology or kind of like where his real commitments actually are. He's always seemed like, you know, I mean, we've talked about this before on the show. You know, Sam Cedar talks about this on the Majority Report quite a bit about, you know, Manchin's brand is what matters to him. It always seemed to be that way, right? Is that he's always got to be a kind of a stick in the mud about stuff. He's always got to be the one who's going to be, you know, insisting that we work across the aisles. He's going to be any Democratic proposal that comes out that seems too Democratic, he's going to be the one who's going to try to rein it back in. And now with the 50-50 split in the Senate, he's got this kind of extraordinary power just to sink anything. And so the question is like, how, you know, to what degree is this about Manchin's branding, and to what degree is this about, you know, something like a ideological commitment that he's willing to have that could potentially like fundamentally upend this infrastructure bill, and I don't know the answer to that, but it seems that the consequences of that, you know, are pretty profound.
Yeah, like. No, I mean it's mind-boggling to say the point. And it's like, I mean, we're at a point where like this infrastructure bill is supported by large swaths of the Republican Party by both parties. Like, every single thing that's been polled on this is polling over like 60-65%. Like, not even like the traditional infrastructure parts. Like, you know, we're talking about like, you know, our medical infrastructure, senior living care facilities, like things that we have been defunding, or Republicans have been defunding for decades now, you know, rural broadband. Like, if there's one thing in, especially here in the state of Pennsylvania, that I learned a lot over the past year, was when we followed those emails, those right to know requests, and we got those COVID emails that we published showing how Russ Diamond and Frank Ryan and all them were conspiring to undermine Governor Wolf's COVID relief orders. There were also a lot of emails between county commissioners and Republican legislators about how their community members are just getting fucked over by the lack of rural broadband access.
Yeah.
Like, getting charged by Comcast $5,000 to lay lines out into their houses. Like, I mean, we've got, if you want to talk about like one of the biggest disconnects between Republican voters and what Republican legislators are doing, it has to be this rural broadband issue. I mean, like, even in parts of Pennsylvania, like, you can't get internet access on your phone. Like, go 10 miles outside of Harrisburg, you can't get access on your phone. You know, there are still parts of Pennsylvania, we know people who are hooked up to like the phone line still, who don't even have high speed internet. You know, and it's just amazing how Manchin is just doing this for Manchin's part, when this bill is supported by like, what, 70% of the country?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, and I think that, look, and I have to say, I mean, I'm going to get sick of hearing myself say this, but I did not expect this degree of boldness. And like I said, this is not sufficient, right? When, especially when you start talking about climate change.
I imagine was talking like 2 weeks ago of a $4 trillion fucking bill.
Well, that's what I don't understand. Is like, that's what I don't understand. And like, you know, here's the thing is like, you know, what Republicans are trying, what they're trying out, they're going back to, you know, their messaging around kind of like, you know, a corporate tax rates. And Biden wants to raise the corporate tax rates in a part to quote unquote pay for it by going from 21% to 28%. Right. And now if you're looking at this in the abstract, you know, nothing about tax policy or anything like this, you're like, oh my God, that's like 7 percentage points. That's a pretty significant blah, blah, blah. Right. But when you take into mind that, like, the only, basically Biden is raising corporate tax rates up to a rate that is lower than before Donald Trump took office. Right. So Donald Trump basically slashed the corporate tax rate in the plan to kind of give back tons of cash, right, to the top 1% and the biggest income earners and wealth owners in the country. Right. So that was what happened under Trump. And so Biden goes up to 28%, and that's not even going back to before Trump, right? I mean, so that's number one. And, you know, if we're talking about, say, fiscal responsibility and how do you pay for stuff and all this other kind of thing, and that's a bigger, broader conversation to have at another point, the Republicans seem to basically want to point to that. And that's the only thing they got. It's like, we can't do corporate tax rate. And there's same old stuff. And Manchin seems to latch on that to a little bit too.
But Manchin was saying, if you expect the rich have to fucking pay for
it. But that's exactly my point. It's like, this is what I was getting to, is I don't understand, like, what the hell the guy is doing. Because, I mean, look, I mean, we don't have time. I mean, okay. My thing is like, look, we don't have time for games here. Right. I mean, you know, there's people, I mean, that global trends report that's come out, you're seeing a whole series of things that are coming out from scientists. You're talking about, you know, economic analysis. There's a letter that came out with something like 22 different kind of like leading economists
and
saying
also, like,
getting bigger.
The unprecedented attacks on voting rights in Republican states around the country.
Exactly.
On top of this report.
But that's my point, right? You see what goes on, right? I mean, we have to look at this in the whole picture. Right. What Republicans are doing right now is attempting to kind of cement, as you have said multiple occasions, right, cement minority rule. Right. And minority rule by the kind of the small cadre of primarily kind of like, you know, the white identity party of the Republican Party. Right. Which continues to shrink. So they're looking for ways to maintain their power. That's what they're doing on the voting rights thing. And so, and what do they want to do? They want to prevent us from addressing climate change. They want to prevent any kind of serious kind of investment in kind of the caring economy. They want to, they do not want to kind of upgrade or provide anything for the public. They want everything to kind of move over to the market. It is
they want to continue their hate with trans bills and stuff like that. Yep. They want to continue their hate going after immigrants. Like, it is, yeah. I mean, it's just like... Like, what the fuck?
Well, so let's look at what we're talking about here just a little bit. I mean, the USA Today did a really nice breakdown of kind of what's in the infrastructure bill, just so we could see what's going on. Because I do think this is worth a little discussion, because it's not just, you know, if you hear say, oh, the infrastructure, invested infrastructure, your mind kind of just goes to particular things. Like, you know, the potholes in the road and, you know, you know, public transportation, a bunch of stuff like this. But the Biden administration has been doing, you know, I am surprised once again, I think a pretty bang up job, and basically saying we need to think about infrastructure as more than just roads and bridges, right? And they made this argument when he was kind of rolling this out too as well, and he's done some pressers after this too as well, which I thought was right on the money. He basically said, look, he's like, when before there were railroads, right? Railroads were not traditional infrastructure. Right. We had to expand our notion of what was infrastructure. Right. We didn't always have an international highway system. Right. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't traditional infrastructure. So we had to expand it in order to do those things. Right. And he went through a kind of series of things like that, which is absolutely right. And if you're talking about the economy going forward to the 21st century with climate change kind of like bearing down on us. Right. If you remember back in what is it? 2018 is like when the climate scientists came up and said, look, we've got 12 years. Well, that's down to 9 years now, right? And so there's got to be bold action. So some of this stuff has got to be, you know, in there is to address climate change. Again, it's not sufficient, but it's pretty significant. But then it also invests in all these other sectors of our economy that have proven, especially after coronavirus, have proven to be absolutely critical infrastructure, like the care economy, right? Like medical care, things like this. So, for example, so the bill, the infrastructure has like $621 billion that is devoted to transportation infrastructure, $650 billion, which they're calling, say, the quality of life at home infrastructure, $400 billion to help for caregivers, and $480 billion for research, development, and manufacturing in order to get a shift away from the carbon economy. And the like I was saying, the USA Today does a really great breakdown of what that means, because usually we say, okay, for transportation, say, okay, what's traditional transportation, you think in your head. But look at this. Of that money, right, that's devoted for transportation, $174 billion is devoted toward establishing an electric vehicles network, right, and 500,000 EV state charging stations, right? That's infrastructure. That's the infrastructure for the next century, right, for electric vehicles. You're talking about $80 billion for like to basically go back, say Amtrak. I'll look at all the repair backlog.
The expansion of Amtrak.
Exactly. Like, right.
I mean, if people don't realize this, like the Philadelphia from Harrisburg line, the Keystone line, Philadelphia, Harrisburg, New York, is probably one of the busiest rail lines, one of the busiest like trails or services like in the country, or Amtrak's like.
Routes, yeah.
One of the busiest routes outside the SL Express. Like, if you're taking a train to Philadelphia in the morning from Harrisburg, the whole entire train is packed.
Yep.
And if the trains that are unloading are packed, like, it's faster for me to go from Philadelphia to Harrisburg and Harrisburg to Philadelphia than it is to go from my parents' house in the suburbs of Philadelphia to drive into Center City, Philadelphia. It's the same amount of time. Like, we're talking about like 100-mile difference.
Yep.
Like, between where my parents live in the suburbs, which is like 15 miles outside of Center City, Philadelphia. It takes an hour and a half just to drive in Center City, Philadelphia from where they live. And it's the same amount of time, like, to go from Philadelphia to Harrisburg and back.
There you go.
Like, it's just, it's, yeah.
Well, I look, there's been proposals right now, like the line that I'm on, right? So you've got this, I forget the route name, but it basically ran from Philadelphia all the way up to Allentown. And I think before that it was from Allentown. You'd probably have to switch trains at that point, but up to Scranton, right? And so the tracks are still there. They run right through my town in Perkasie, right? To kind of right up there. And I look at that, I'm like, here you go. Now, again, I was disappointed to see that was not on one of those kind of like proposed little route things. But still, that's this kind of investment that can happen. Like, imagine if you talk about, you know, coming from Horsham to being like an hour and a half to get down to Philly. Imagine you're up in Allentown, right? Up in, you know, it takes like forever to get down like into Philly, kind of like in the center city. Imagine you hop on a train, you go right there. Imagine what that would do, right, for connecting people up, right, and not having to rely upon kind of like, you know, single passenger automobiles in order to get back and forth to work, for example.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, it's impressive. Let me just touch on a couple of things here. And one of the other points of the infrastructure bill, this is the quality of life at home stuff, right? So what does that all mean? Well, check some of these things out. It means retrofitting more than 2 million homes and commercial properties, right, to basically bring them up to code, make them more energy efficient. That's huge. What Sean was mentioning before, expand high-speed broadband, $100 billion, right, to make sure that the rural sections of the state are connected. Right. And I'll tell you this, after a year now of teaching and kind of like an all online environment, you know, the students that had the most difficulty, right, in doing that were students that were kind of lived in rural communities, because the infrastructure is so bad, right, that they don't have high speed internet. Right.
It's still on dial up.
Well, my students weren't, you know, but there is sections that are just on dial up.
I know. Like, yeah, like you're still on a landline, like a phone line.
Yep. Absolutely. And then, so what else do they want to do? They basically want to improve the electrical grid. And we saw what happened in Texas. This is why you have to do this. They want to upgrade childcare facilities in high need areas. This is some of the kind of innovations in this kind of understanding of infrastructure, investing in the caring economy, right? I mean, I'm telling you, it's absolutely kind of amazing how they're beginning thinking about it. They're talking about new workers in public lands and waters. They're talking about $100 billion investment in public schools, to upgrade and build new public schools, right? Then look at caregivers for the elderly, right? That's that kind of like, what are they doing? $400 billion for caregivers for elderly and disabled folks, right? That's unbelievable. Right. Because in our country, like we've either turned over most of our, you know, most of our kind of like caregiving to like, you know, trying to, you know, people trying to make ends meet and trying to care for loved ones, or hand it over to kind of for profit kind of like elder care facilities. Right. Or some kind of nonprofit ones, which are underfunded. And here you got an investment in that kind of being able to kind of like, you know, care for folks at home. Research, development, manufacturing one, like domestic manufacturer supporting or rural manufacturing of clean energy. Like, again, you look at these places that are underserved by our economy, like that have been devastated by kind of a lack of, you know, one kind of companies closing up, moving overseas and that kind of stuff. Right. And then you see them kind of like say, no, Biden comes along and said, no, we want to invest in actually building manufacturers in those exact communities. You want upgrading research infrastructure and laboratories, technology to address the climate crisis. I mean, and I mentioned this before too, as well, is that some of that, right, the technology, they want to establish these centers, and they've kind of set aside, especially kind of $10 billion, right, specifically to set up some of that research and development at HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. Right. I mean, it's just, I'm telling you, and $30 billion for preventing future pandemics. You know, I mean, all this stuff, I mean, we're talking about absolutely essential and necessary things that we have basically walked away from as a country for the past four decades. And so on one hand, it's outstanding. Now, so then you put that back in the fact that you've got Republicans are trying to do everything in their possible to kind of strip away the ability for us to be actually represented by people by stripping away our voting rights. And you've got these kind of centrist Democrats, in particular Joe Manchin, but also Kristen Sinema, who are playing games with this stuff. I mean, I don't know about you, Sean, but I just can't get a read on the politics of what the hell they're thinking.
I think that they see themselves in their power position as being that 50th vote. Like, it's not Biden that controls the Senate. It's the person who wants to be that last vote that controls it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I mean, you know, it's time to start playing politics with them.
Yeah, I mean, I know. I mean, it seems like they're kind of like caring more about their kind of individual kind of identities and brand than they are actually doing stuff that is necessary. And like you said, this stuff is incredibly, incredibly popular.
Yeah. I mean, also, I thought we were talking about before this, with Janet Yellen.
Yeah, proposing... just want to talk. Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Huge.
Janet Yellen proposing a international minimum corporate tax rate. Like, you know, no, I mean, like, you were talking about this, like, being in Dr. Schnell's class.
Yep.
Before this. And, I mean, like, no, these were ideas that were, like, we were learning about 10 years ago in our globalization class and stuff like that. I mean, it's, you know, it seems like it's we're almost seeing a passing of that neoliberal torch, or a fading of that neoliberal policies.
Yeah.
You know, of the past 30 or 40 years. And it's like, of all people to be doing this, it's Biden.
I'll be the first to admit that I did not see this coming at all. I mean, you know, again, I did not expect it, but I am super impressed. Again,
I mean, it almost feels like he's being a transformative president with everything that's going on.
Well, do you remember some of the, you know, we had this discussion back. I was actually going to Dr. Schnell's class, Steve Schnell's class, is like where I should say, just for everybody out there. So every year, since I've been at Kutztown, almost every year, this guy, Steve Schnell, he's in the geography department. He came in at Kutztown the same year I did. We were kind of friends from the get-go. And he started doing this kind of this class. I think it was in his second or third year, called the Geographies of Globalization. Spaces of Globalization.
Probably also like one of my favorite classes. I think I took it at Kutztown.
Yeah, and he started inviting me to come to the class because I was working on kind of global justice stuff, global justice movements. I was looking at the rhetorics of globalization and social movements. And one of the first times I went into that class, Sean was sitting in the front row, right? And that's how I met Sean Kitchen, right? Because it was like the next day or something like that. Like there he is again, sitting outside my office door.
Right? No, it was a couple years later. Yeah, it was after when Corbett announces budget attacks.
I didn't realize it was that long afterward. I had this picture in my head that it was like the later that week.
No. It was
anyways, whatever. Go. Yeah. Are you still there?
Oh yeah, I'm still here. Sorry, I'm going back and forth with my Instacart order.
Oh my god, good.
Yeah, globalization. No, I mean like you know, I remember you speaking, and you know, it was a couple years later. Once Corbyn announces budget attacks, and I show up to your office and I'm like, yo, fuck this shit.
And then
the chicken started.
Yeah, I mean, I, like, literally was like launching the chicken as like Sean showed up at my door, like, and I'm like, well, just so happens, you know, like.
But I mean, it's also like, you know, like how I got into activism from after that.
With Occupy. You know,
Occupy and everything else, and the internship, and now here I am in Harrisburg.
There you go. So anyways, the point was that in Snell's class this week, you know, I, as part of what I was talking about there this week was, I was saying, you know, this is gonna, and I told him at the head of it, this is gonna be an uncharacteristically upbeat meeting, because for the first time, I think, since I've been doing those things, I've actually felt that we're on the precipice of a significant change. It's fragile. There's no guarantee that it's going to happen. But you see things like this. What Janice Yellen did this week, like as this example, and I talked about it in his class too as well, is like, but what Janice Yellen did this week by making the proposal, again, this is, she did this at a conference, right? She did this in Chicago, but a pretty influential conference. And it's her way of bringing this stuff out, basically saying, calling for a minimum corporate tax, a global minimum corporate tax, right? And because basically what we've seen happening for the past 40, 50 years now, she says 30 years, but I would mark it a little bit back further, is this race to the bottom where these corporations can move any place that they want in the world, right? There's no barriers to them, right? Nobody's trying to kind of check their IDs at the border, right? They're welcomed in with open arms, and then people bid to try to kind of find out, like, you know, who can hand them more stuff, right? And they would go to where the labor costs were the lowest, right? And so they kept on bouncing around with no investments in those communities. And, you know, that's the race to the bottom. American workers once had kind of good jobs, saw those disappear literally overnight. Because those corporations, it was cheaper for them to pick up and go to China than it was to basically kind of invest in their communities. And that was enabled by conscious policies that were enacted by Democrats and Republicans through the neoliberal era. And what Janet Yellen, when she comes in and calls for that minimum corporate tax, that was an idea that I can remember back in like 1999, 2000. Right, these people in the World Social Forum, these kind of global justice movements, were kind of talking about that as, you know, this is what we should be doing, and so it's like it felt like, yeah, you know, we're activists on the fringes, and now to see the Secretary of the Treasury bring this up as a policy goal that she said she wants to talk with Europe about moving towards that kind of agreement, that's monumental, right? Is it going to happen right away? It's like no, but the fact that that's actually being put forth as a reasonable solution to what we have right now shows you how far things shift in a pretty kind of tight time frame. So,
yeah, and I mean, it's also it's amazing how this isn't the type of people that Obama put in his cabinet either. Right. Like with Deitner, you know, I'm trying to think of like who else, Rahm Emanuel, who were really upholding the neoliberal order, like during those years while Obama was in office.
Yeah, those people are not there. and those few that are there are not in
Larry Summers.
Yeah, like... right, Larry Summers, right, exactly. I was about to say, he's like he controlled basically, you know, he controlled. He had influence and he had Obama's ear, right, in terms of economic policy. No longer the case. Larry Summers is now on the fringes. So that's pretty amazing. You know, and I listened to, you know, some interviews with Stephanie Kelton and who's, you know, Modern Monetary Theory, her book, her amazing book that I'm reading right now, kind of almost done with actually, called The Deficit Myth is outstanding. She talks about, you know, seeing a bunch of the kinds of policies, right? Getting a hearing in the White House like they never have before. And she was contrasting both what happened to the Obama administration to the Biden administration. And she's like, it's a sea change. So, I mean, we are maybe on this precipice. But again, you know, and this is what I said in that class, it's fragile because, you know, all the movement that the amazing movements that were taking place in the late 1990s, early 2000s around global justice stuff, that stuff was just killed overnight after 9/11. And that set back that movement by, you know, again, a generation. And so
we also are seeing that, like, I mean, like going back to the report or what Michael Pape wrote, like,
right,
you know, all this is, you know, the thing about globalization is, and like with geography and political geography, all this stuff ties together on the local, this regional, the national, and like the international scales. Like, it's, you know, it's one of the things about like trying to think about this type of stuff, like how it impacts on the different scales of like everything. And I mean, the insurrection happened like because of our international and national economic policies, you know, like it
absolutely
happened. Yes. Yes. Because I mean, like, yeah, racism, I do believe racism played a major part with it, but like, you know, it's also the generation of people who watch their pensions get destroyed or like, you know, or perceive like, you know, like them, like what's like, you know, perceive Mexicans and Latin Americans as a threat to their economic security. I mean, I think racism plays a part with it, but it's also, it's all connected. And I think like, you know, having a strong economic policy will tamp down a lot of the shit. I mean, we're seeing it here in Harrisburg with these Proud Boy rallies that are going on.
Right.
Most of these people are unemployed, out of work, and they're collecting COVID money, COVID relief, unemployment benefits. You know, and I feel like when these people actually have decent jobs, like it won't solve their racism, but it'll tamp that shit down a bit.
No, but you know, but it also points the way to the kind of solutions, right? Like, so one of the other books I'm reading right now is Heather McGee's book called The Sum of Us. And it's what racism cost everyone. And it's reading that with Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, is pretty amazing, because basically what she, like, let me give you just a perfect example. What she says, when she's talking about basic, I mean, she's talking essentially about kind of the structure of racism and kind of white supremacy and the way that that actually functions. And she, and it's one chapter, she's talking about the ways that, what happened with like swimming pools, right? Public swimming pools, right? In the 1950s, like there was this huge infrastructure investment, right, into building public swimming pools, right? Because it was seen like, you know, look, everyone goes to the pool, everyone has access to it. And like, instead of it being like, who's got a tuxedo on and who's dressed and who's like, no, everyone's in their freaking swimsuits and they're all swimming, right? The, and it was this idea about this ethos. Of course, it happened at the time where you have the peak number of labor unions active, which has a lot to do with it. But that we're going to kind of like invest in community. Right. And what Heather McGee says, well, yeah, it was a community, but it was a white community. Right. It was in a white ideal. And even though a lot of those white people didn't understand that consciously what they were doing at the time, but some of them did. But then what happened is like in this, through the civil rights movement. Right. There, you know, she uses this one example in St. Louis where there was this pool. There was a pool. There was a zoo around this complex. It was one of the biggest pools in the world, like municipal pools in the world. There was a huge parklands around it. There was a zoo connected to it, like I said. And when the Supreme Court basically found that, you know, communities had to desegregate, right, that they couldn't exclude people because they were black, right? If it's a publicly funded thing, they're part of the public, everyone gets to come in, right? And what a lot of these communities did, right, including, like, I think the St. Louis one lasted for another couple of years, but what a lot of these communities did, they filled in their pools and shut it off to everyone, so that they could maintain white control. And then they set up these private pool things, right? So you have these private pool houses. So, and what Heather McGee's point there is that that is how deep this is, right? Is that and this is how it, destructive as it even is to white folks, is that these, the ruling elites, the white supremacist ruling elites, right? That white power structure is willing to deny all of us of anything in order to maintain a racial hierarchy, in order to maintain the inequality and the control over the economic lives of all of us, right? And racism is one of the primary tools of it. And so anyways, this is a long way around to coming back to this bill, to basically, you know, coming back to all the stuff we were just talking about, is saying, unlike any other time, at least in my life, is like the solutions to these problems, right? People's awareness of the size and the scope of each one of these problems, white supremacy, climate change, inequalities, right? Those things, right, is matched by a policy set like any other time. And those things have been coming together thanks to the work of organizers, thanks to the work of people on the ground, thanks to kind of like, you know, people basically realizing, especially when the pandemic, right, that we need to respond to this stuff, that these ways of thinking about the market's going to solve us all, it's no longer resonating with people. And unlike what happened in 1999, 2000 with the global justice movement, there are ideas lying around, as to put it in Milton Friedman's terms. So it's pretty impressive. So I don't know. I'm talking way on, Sean. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, what's that?
That we're hopeful.
Yeah, I am. I'm a little gushing today, I have to say, for something. At the same time, I'm like, whatever is what matches. Let's close out this section. Just like, we got to talk about, you know, the major media story of the week. As if that was not, right? It has to be with the Mr. Gates.
Oh my God. So many women talking about the past couple weeks. Okay. So, first of all, what Matt Gaetz did was, or alleged, accused of doing, you know, what he most likely did and will probably be going to jail for is horrific. It's, you know, like, yes, he should be going to jail for what he did. But there's also like Schadenfreude involved with this too. Like, I'm glad this fucker is going away for some time, like for a long time, probably. You know, his associate, Joel Greenberg, which I don't get how he's like the small fish in all this compared to like, because of like the power and the money that he has. But it seems like he's flipping on Gates. Did you see the lawyer yesterday?
I was just about to ask you if you saw that. You mean the lawyer? Or is the lawyer? Did you hear the guy, the reporter from the Daily Beast, about the documents they got?
No.
All right, I'll get to that in a second. Go ahead. Talk about the lawyer. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So the lawyer was just like slow walking the answer. Like, you know.
He kept on repeating the questions. He kept on repeating the questions.
Am I in Matt Gaetz's head? And it just like ends it with a drop the hammer. I'd be very concerned if I was Matt Gaetz. Like, pretty much like, yeah, this you're getting fucking rolled on. Like, the interview he had with Tucker Carlson.
It seemed like
a year ago at this point. Like,
right.
Just like, that was just like phenomenal. How he just like, come on, Tucker, you remember? She was with us at dinner that one night. Like, just like totally implicating Tucker and all that. And then like the other stuff. Also, was the Daily Beast story the one about like the Venmo transaction?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. So pro tip, if you're going to be criming, don't be using Venmo to be criming. No. Unless you have to pay your marijuana entrepreneurs.
Right. Well, of course. or what do they call it?
His marijuana entrepreneur.
Yeah, there's a word somebody was using for it, and I can't remember what it was. Anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, but I mean, just like, it's amazing how fucking stupid this guy is. I mean, like, and how blatant he was, like, all kidding aside, with what happened. And it makes you wonder if any other politicians were involved with this, especially with the stories of him showing, like, his trophy pictures around the House floor to, like, other legislators.
Right.
You know, like, yeah, there should be calls for him to resign. He should, like, resign, should have resigned, like, yesterday at this point. But no, I mean, like, it's rather pleasing seeing one of Trump's biggest sycophants in the House get brought down and go to jail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if he had resigned, right, like earlier, or not been so stupid in the way he handled his media, like the Tucker Carlson interview and so on, basically just keep on going on and start spending more.
I mean,
nonsense.
If you're the comms director, you'd have to resign at that point anyway, like just because of the fucking interview he did.
Oh, totally.
Like, do you want to be like the person that had to field those questions? Like, sorry, man, this is all on you. You screwed up. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, exactly. He's one of the things that let's talk, what the Daily Beast said, he was on, I think, Chris Hayes last night, but the story that basically came out of the Venmo transactions is basically what there's messages going to Joel Greenberg from Matt Gaetz, right? Basically saying, hey, hit up, and he names these women or girls. It's unclear about like how old they were. One of the what people they think may have been underage in some of this stuff. And they say, hit up this person, right? Then what Matt Gaetz did is that he ended up sending
$900.
Greenberg $900 through Venmo, right? And then Greenberg, like moments later, right, transfers that same amount of money to that person's account that Gaetz mentioned. Right. So when Gaetz says, like, hey, I never paid for it, right? Well, he had a middleman. Right. And so basically he's trying to walk that line. And like what they said in the Daily Beast, the reporters of the Daily Beast was on Chris Hayes last night, was basically saying, yeah, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We've got all these documents. Right. There's going to be a lot more. Gaetz is going down hard.
I Gaetz seems like the type of person is going to have a public meltdown. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's. I mean, yeah, he's not the type of person. He doesn't look like the type of person that's like taking this reality check seriously. And, you know, I hope there's no collateral damage from him taking this public meltdown.
Yeah, we shall see. We shall see.
Yeah.
It's going to be a blow up. But I have to share that. I'm like, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
So
if I had to pick one of the most. one of the people I detest most in Congress right now, he's one of them. And, you know, and
I mean, Jim Jordan is like,
Exactly.
Like Jim Jordan fucking standing up for him. Like, you know, like that motherfucker.
That's one hell of a club right there.
Yeah.
So crazy. But yeah, so kind of Matt Gaetz, too bad for poor Matt Gaetz. Anyways, Sean, you got anything else kind of on the national picture before we kind of head over into a little bit more stuff close to home?
Nothing too much. I think that's pretty much it. So
good. I'm a little bit off my game. I'll admit it today, especially with we had the tech stuff and not being able to see you is hard. I'm just saying.
I'm just glad my phone's working pretty good.
Yeah. No, it's working pretty good. All right, so we're gonna take a quick break. We'll come back. We're gonna get into our PA focus. Remind you that you can help support Raging Chicken by going to patreon.com/rcpress. That's patreon.com/rcpress. You become a patron for as little as $5 a month to help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today, and help get the word out. We'll be back right after this quick break with more What's Going On Here in PA.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1865. That was the day Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox, Virginia. Grant's Union Army successfully cut off Confederate forces at the village of Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. Historians agree the terms were generous to the Confederacy. The surrender marked the beginning of the end of the Civil War, with three more key surrenders before the end of May. Half the country was in ruins, with as many as 750,000 dead. In the North alone, millions more lay seriously injured. At least 40,000 formerly enslaved blacks died fighting for their freedom. It was considered the country's turning point. The Civil War ended the slave system, forged a centralized federal government, and created a national structure for the institutional development of public health, veteran care, and aid programs. The era of Reconstruction ushered in a period of hope and opportunity for black freedom, equality, and prosperity. But historian Gregory Downs argues in his book After Appomattox, Military Occupation and the Ends of the War, that the war did not really end in 1865. The South was essentially under military occupation until at least 1871. Downs writes, quote, "By severing the war's conflict from the Reconstruction that followed, it drained meaning from the Civil War and turned it into a family feud, a fight that ended with regional reconciliation. Once white Southern Democrats overthrew Reconstruction, they utilized the Appomattox myth to erase the connection between the popular, neatly concluded Civil War and the continuing battles of Reconstruction." For Eric Foner, the period was one of revolution and counter-revolution, a massive experiment in interracial democracy without precedent. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast, here once again with none other than the vaccinated shitposter himself, Sean Kitchen. Welcome back to our PA Focus. It's Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. Sean, man, you got a lot of stuff, man. I was surprised. I logged in this morning. I'm like, holy crap, Sean has been like on it, right?
I had my coffee nice and early this morning.
Look at that. All right, so why don't you lead us off? What you got for us today?
Let's talk about Candida. Like, congratulations to Candida with her new job. She's gonna become the executive director of
this is Candida Kenner, everybody.
Yes, the new Pennsylvania project. She's been working with We the People, and you know, where she's been a woman with many hats over the past several years with all the projects she's been working on with the stopping judicial gerrymandering in the state, you know, going after why courts matter, We the People, and stuff that like other projects that's being run out of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Institute. She's going to be focusing on voting rights, which is going to be a really big topic in the coming months and coming weeks.
Yeah, I'll say.
Here in Pennsylvania. You know, Republicans are going to be gearing up for that. And No, I mean, like, I think bigger picture, working in the progressive movement in the state, it's amazing seeing this investment happening in the progressive movement in the state. Like, it's almost like a feeling at the, with like the winds are at our backs right now.
Yeah, I'll say, look, and I can't think of somebody like better to be of leading this right now.
I'm probably like the best person for this.
Right. I mean, it's like you're talking about somebody who's been, you know, kind of like, you know, she's not even cut her teeth. I mean, she has been instrumental in so many different areas, everything from the policy end of things into the organizational level of things. She's been, anytime you see a major initiative happening here, as a chances are, she's been involved in it. And so, you know, she's got the experience. She is kind of the kind of person you want out in front to know that she is going to be, you know, a champion around voting rights, kind of leading that charge is amazing. And so, you know, like, super congratulations to her. I mean, I love the work that she's been doing at the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center to begin with the We the People. We saw the People's Budget come out. That's kind of, you know, again, this is coming from her desk, basically. You know, so super congratulations to her. I cannot wait to see how this gets rolled out. And, you know, I can't say, you know, I have to say, it's like, you know, it couldn't be sooner. You know what I mean? I mean, this is like the perfect, I mean, let's do it now. Like, or I say it could be the only thing, I'm saying this wrong. What I mean to say is this, is like, it's like now is the time for this to happen. And for that to basically, ahead of the midterm elections, for her to be kind of on here ahead of the kind of all the gerrymandering fights and the voter suppression attempts, for her to take that lead is going to be, you know, just phenomenal.
Yeah. Now, I will say one thing. I'm not too concerned about the represent us with the gerrymandering, the partisan gerrymandering that's going to be happening, because I really don't think like what people are talking about or realize is that the Democrats now control the Supreme Court in this state. And the Democrats will have the final say in the maps that are made for the state legislature in 2022. So, like, next year, we're going to have an open Senate seat. We're going to have an open governor's seat. And we're going to be fighting for the control of the legislature.
Yep.
Like, let's just say it's a great time being in Harrisburg right now.
I mean, Sean embraces it. Yeah.
The weather's great. The deck is awesome. You know, we were talking about this on the phone. I'm gushing over this. You know, I'm hopeful. Like, it feels a lot different than like the existential dread and doom and gloom that was all of 2020 with COVID, the reopening, you know, a fascist coup, overturning election, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying. Like, it just feels a lot more hopeful than like last year. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like we weathered a storm. We weathered a pretty big storm. We won. We got the Senate. You know, I think we saw what happens if the progressive movement flexes its muscle, and when we organize. And you know, I don't think there's a better time for a project to be launching like this in Pennsylvania, and I don't think there's a better person like in the movement that to be doing this. Like, it's, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to what she's going to do. And I'm really just looking forward to like what's going to happen next year. I feel like as a movement, we're coalescing, and it feels a lot hopeful, and it feels great.
Well, that's good news. And it's also good news to hear that, you know, to hear that you're not as concerned about the gerrymandering stuff. That's really good. I wanted to put that on in particular today because I want to get your take on that, because that's that just kind of,
I think there's going to be shenanigans, and like, I think we'll have to beat back the potential gerrymandering amendment coming up at the Supreme Court. But I haven't looked into it, but I know a lot of people are making fuss over it. The way the process works is that there are now negotiations going on between the House and Senate caucuses. You know, the four leaders from both caucuses decide over a fifth person to board that gerrymandering commission.
Right.
And obviously it's a 2-2 split. And the way this has worked before is that the Supreme Court always appoints the fifth person. So we've had Republican controlled Supreme Courts for the past 50 years, pretty much, during this time period. And the Republicans have been picking the fifth and deciding vote and who gets to draw the House and Senate maps. Now, this isn't congressional lines. This is just like the state, the lines for the state.
Right.
You know, and let's face it, like the Republican that was picked the last time was this guy named Judge McEwen, who wasn't very lucid. If you talk to Roxbury, wasn't all with it, playing, you know, older white guy who was saying the most insane shit and like just went along with the, whatever maps that Dominic Pileggi's office put forward. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is where like Red Map came from.
Right, with, right.
Like, and you know, we have the opportunity to straighten out a lot of these lines and, you know, make sure these districts are fair and, you know, benefit from these changes. Like, I mean, I don't see the Democrats being able to gerrymander the map the way the Republicans did, but like, we'll be able to straighten out a bunch of these districts that are just completely asinine and be able to do that. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm hopeful. I hope I'm saying all the right things with this, but I think like that's where I'm leaning. Like, I don't know if they think it's going to be a partisan gerrymander just because the Democrats control it. And that's what they're talking about, bipartisan.
Well, I mean, I think what, you know, yeah. I mean, and I think that, you know, when represent.us, when they represent us come out with that threat index and moving up to yellow,
it's also like, this is like the March on Harrisburg organization that funds them. And like, this is like, they're an anti-gerrymandering. They want the Citizens Commission and stuff like that. So it's like, we're always.
Right. But my point is this, like, if you read what they're saying, is like, they're pretty kind of careful about saying like, you know, this is not, we're not kind of sending up flares and saying like all hands on deck right now. We're just kind of pointing to something. And I think the goal there was with, you say, you know, again, when you start noticing when, say, Republicans, both, you know, Republicans who are in office, but also their kind of think tanks and their associated institutions, when they are actually starting to pay attention to it or doing little shenanigans, then you get this kind of like index gets kind of kicked up a little bit, right, each year.
Yeah, but anyways, no, yeah. I also you know, speaking about voting rights, here in Pennsylvania, you know, so we've had a couple of things. So what we've reported here at PA Spotlight over the past several months, we've been putting out, is that Seth Grove is an ALEC board member, right? He's an executive board member from the American Legislative Exchange Council. And ALEC was influential in pushing election integrity reforms post-election 2020. These people were meeting literally like December 5th, like before the Electoral College's votes were casted, were certified in those states, in the states the following week, and coming up with schemes to push election integrity onto, like, that's even like the wrong framing. It's not election integrity, it's voter restrictions, voter access restrictions. Like, they've been game planning this out since December. And I think what we're now seeing, what's happening here in Pennsylvania, is that we're now moving on to the policy discussion. And of course, like, I think what Seth Grove is doing, he wants there to be a specter of legitimacy to these hearings,
right?
You know, by bringing in nonpartisan professionals, you know, bringing in, but he's also bringing in completely partisan hacks who are also associated with the American Legislative Exchange Council. And these are people that are pushing for voter IDs. They're going after the money that came into the state to set up the infrastructure for voter ballot boxes in Philadelphia. Like, they're upset that like Mark Zuckerberg gave out grants. And that the Democratic side, Democrats in these counties were competent enough to apply for these grants to get the money to make their ballot box drop boxes and have these drop boxes set up across the state or have massive drop box locations. So what I think is going to happen, right, what's been happening with these hearings, is that these officials, these professional officials and these elected officials from other states who have been testifying have been lifting up their voter systems. And these voter systems are a lot more expansive than Pennsylvania's. right? So in the Senate side, there was a hearing with a person from Denver, Colorado, Denver County, explaining how voters love using their drop boxes and how they have like 40 drop boxes around the county of Denver in Colorado, right? You have people testifying saying what we need is pre-canvassing, right? So there are these legitimate things that like are being said in these hearings. But what I think is going to happen with the Republicans and what they're going to do is pick out the worst, turn them into sound clips, and then use that to as the hammer to bludgeon voting rights here in Pennsylvania. Huh. You know, like Seth Grove has had people from the Honest Elections or some Heritage Foundation group that I have Honest Election Reforms or something like that. And then the Foundation for Government Accountability. Like, and I'm pretty sure there's going to be more people to come out with this. Chris Kobach was having dinner the other night. Like how this happened, were that they were at this fancy restaurant out in Progress called the Progress Grill. And there was about, I think like two or three dozen Republicans and Chris Kobach there eating dinner, talking about election reform stuff. And the way they got spotted was because people on the Democratic side just happened to be out at dinner at the same place at the same time and noticed what was going on. And that story got leaked to Caruso, who got the scoop at the Pennsylvania Capital Star. And it shows you what is coming down the pike right here for Pennsylvania in terms of voting rights.
There you have it. So this is an all hands on deck kind of thing then.
Yeah. Governor Wolf has vowed to veto anything like this to come up. But, you know, Republicans will be pushing these reforms, because what they're doing, what Seth Grove is doing, is trying to make that these hearings with he's trying to give off this perception of legitimacy by having both sides testifying. But I think what's going to happen is they're going to cherry pick the absolute worst.
Yeah.
And do this. Like, we're going to see voter ID get brought back up again. We're going to be seeing lies about immigrants voting in elections. You know, for those who don't remember, Chris Kobach was like the person Trump put in charge to go after voter fraud claims.
Right.
After the 2016 election.
Yep.
like this guy, it does nothing but fuck over election results.
Right. That is his MO, without a doubt.
Yeah. So the fact that the Republicans are doing it, and the fact that, you know, I was talking to some reps, they were surprised that they were so blatant about it, or that stupid to be doing it that open in public somewhere.
Well, here we go.
I mean, it makes you wonder what goes on. Like, at this meeting, you had Chris Dush there, you had Daryl Metcalf, you had Valerie Gatos, you had some of the absolute worst people in the Republican caucuses there meeting with him. Like, the arch conservatives in that group, Russ Diamond, Frank Ryan, you know, Psarkic or whatever, Maloney, like, you had all these representatives out there. The people who spread Trump's big lies are about the election, the people who spoke at the Stop the Steal rallies here in Harrisburg after the election, they were all meeting with Chris Kobach.
Well, so I think it's pretty much the chance is absolutely zero that nothing comes out of that meeting. Right. I mean, so in other words, you know, we're going to see an assault in Pennsylvania on voting rights.
Yes. So
what it seems to me then too, as well, is also, you know, this is probably like, if it makes sense, I mean, you know, Chris Kobach kind of works like this too. They're probably, you know, looking to, oops, what did I just do? Oh God, sorry. Looking to assemble, trying to kind of get a sense and assemble who are the people that are going to lead that charge. Right. Because, you know, Pennsylvania, you know, up and, you know, like, well, I mean, you know, recently has been kind of getting a lot of recognition in the Republican circles, especially right-wing Republican circles, for its kind of like embracement of Trumpism and, you know, the big lie and all this stuff. So I'm sure this is kind of like an assemblage, you know, kind of let's get everybody in the room, see who we've got, so that we know what we're working with as we roll this out.
Yeah. I'm going to say there's at least 24 there. Like, you know, there were a lot of Republicans at this hearing or at this secret meeting.
Yeah.
So
crazy. One thing, anything else about the voting rights stuff before one thing I want to say before we kind of go on to something else.
Not a whole lot about the voting rights going on. So that's pretty much it.
All right. Well, in the voting thing, I didn't originally put this in the notes today. I thought we would talk about it more next week. We will talk about this more next week. But the news did break as we were kind of going into recording that, the Amazon workers, voted down the union, that the final results are being reported. National Labor Relations Board announced that out of 3,041 potentially valid votes, 1,798 workers at the plant they were voting on voted against the union, while only 738 workers voted in favor. There are still 505 ballots that have been contested, but even if all those ballots go into the column for the union, then they'll come up shy. So this is a pretty kind of pretty significant defeat. There's the kind of anti-labor and anti-union work that went in from Amazon to kind of crush the union there. It was pretty outstanding. Outstanding is that like just absolutely crazy about how much they did. But there's going to be a lot more about this. So we're going to talk more about this when we get on the show next week. But I did want to give that update since it kind of came in as was here. I was a little bit skeptical about the numbers that we were hearing last night, which was basically a 2-1 against forming a union. Thought maybe we might see different numbers this morning. But no, that's kind of pretty much kind of held up for the most part. So this is a pretty historic defeat on the one hand. On the flip side of that, right? This is Sarah Nelson was saying this last night on the Mediasan show, was that, you know, it's only a matter of time now before there's a union at Amazon. So the movement is stronger than ever. Nonetheless, even though that this battle has been lost at the moment.
Yeah. There was one thing I wanted to put in there. I forgot to. Did you see what happened yesterday with Shapiro?
No, I did not.
And the prevailing wage. This is actually a pretty big deal. So one of the largest donors for the Senate Republicans, one of Jake Corbin's best friends, got hit with the largest Davis-Bacon charges in United States history.
I don't know what Davis-Bacon charges are. What are they?
Davis-Bacon is prevailing wage.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. I didn't know so that. It's the largest federal or largest prevailing wage charges ever levied against the company. Glenn O'Hallbaker in Centre County is a contractor that's benefited from the construction projects over the past decade, regarding especially with the Marcellus Shale. They got over $1.7 billion in contracts from PennDOT over this time. They shorted their workers over $20 million in prevailing wages.
Wow.
They were paying the workers what they should have been paid on the job site, but they were scamming the workers on the back end through their health benefits and pension or through their benefits. Basically, they were overbilling how much money that they were supposedly paying for healthcare costs and then pocketing that money. So
crazy.
This pretty much neutralizes Jake Corbin if he tries to run for U.S. or for governor. Next year. I know. I mean, it just shows you why Republicans love going after the prevailing wage here in Pennsylvania. They do not believe in paying workers for what they should be paid, especially when it comes to construction projects. They think that workers should be paid. There should be no prevailing wage for that. And that they think that owners like this should be able to pocket this money and steal from the workers.
Yep.
For their labor. So I'm sure Rick will be talking about this some point this week.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely get on the Rick Smith show for this one. I mean, Rick will be covering it, I'm sure, full.
I mean, prevailing wage is that's like the one thing I learned from Rick is the prevailing wage and why Republicans love going after it. But yeah, Shapiro dropped the hammer on a GOP donor yesterday for scamming the prevailing wage laws in Pennsylvania for the past decade.
Awesome. Good. That's a good sign. But we could say in kind of in less competent areas of the state, we see people like Scott Perry still trying to figure out how to use Venn diagrams. So.
It took me like a good 2 hours looking at the diagram, like wondering what the fuck did he do wrong? And then I like looked at it, I was like, oh. Like, yeah.
Yeah, do check out. I put a link to the to the image in there. It's just to the original one. It basically, for those folks listening to it on the podcast, if you like, you got three circles, Venn diagram, right? Overlapping things. The top circle says leaders taking COVID-19 seriously. Then bottom left hand side says leaders protecting the Constitution, individuals, and preventing harmful government overreach on the left side. And then on the right side, a lower that says leaders trying to prevent impending economic doom due to authoritarianism. And then, you know, where the circles overlap, right? You know, there. So he takes me, right? He puts me in where the two bottom circles overlap, right? So his intention, because he corrects this later on, was to put it like where the three circles overlap, right? So it's like leaders taking it seriously, protecting the Constitution, and preventing economic doom. So that was his argument that he's making. But instead he said, no, I'm one of the people, leaders protecting the Constitution, individuals preventing harmful government, and leaders trying to prevent economic doom, but I am not taking COVID-19 seriously. Which was, more accurate description of his actual policy, right?
Yeah. I mean, but even like fighting authoritarianism, I mean, this guy was the one who tried like helping Trump with his coup, so...
Yep. Exactly. So, just absolutely had to put that in there because that guy does not deserve to be there, and Shanna does.
Yeah,
right, Shanna. Anyway, so we just had to put that in. A couple things to kind of close
that
out.
That podcast.
Here. What's that?
On Monday, the podcast with Cyril on Monday, or Cyril?
Cyril, yeah.
Last Monday was amazing. Just got to plug that.
Oh, good. Awesome. Glad you liked it. I mean, it's like he got
like the third or fourth, like Out the Coup Live I listened to. I mean, like I let you do your thing. But no, like that was definitely
let me do my thing. Oh, that's so gracious of you. Like you have any freaking control over me at all.
No.
You let me do it.
I usually like Monday when you like broadcast, I had a few beers and, you know, just not
okay. But it was a great conversation, and Cyril is just like it's totally worth a listen if you haven't listened to it already. I mean, Cyril, I think is just a phenomenal individual, right? And the fact that he's writing a progressive column, kind of a biweekly column at the Bucks County Courier Times and the Intelligencer, is outstanding. And so, you know, we talked a lot about some of the Pennridge School District and some of the background here. We talked a lot about the rise of extremism and right-wing extremism in Pennsylvania, why it's so important to pay attention to this stuff.
And it also, like, reminded me, like, the podcast, reminded me of the Scott Wagner event I went to in Montgomery County a few years ago when he made the Young and Naive comments. Like, that was one of my first, like, holy shit moments of how fucking insane the Republicans have gotten, especially in Montgomery and Bucks counties.
Yep.
Like, these are not like the moderate Republicans like Todd Stevens, which, well, whatever. Like, I'm like that brand of Republicans that we see in office. Like, these are like the QAnon conspiracy theorists that like gained a lot of prominence after Trump and gained prominence because of the collapse of their local parties and the party infrastructure.
Right.
Like, yeah.
So no, I mean, and it's like, look, and I think that why this is gonna be so important because you know, I think we've talked about it here. We saw the data that came out about how Bucks County was the county that sent the most number of people to the insurrection from Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania is kind of the leading state. I believe it's still number one in the number of people that we sent down to the insurrection on January 6th. And we saw that report came out that I mentioned at the top of the show where we said we see that this is the kind of county that seems to be this extremism and people, organized groups of people willing to resort to violence is happening in counties like Bucks County, where we see significant demographic shifts, right? We don't see like the same kind of thing happening in these like deeply red counties. We see it happening in these transitional counties where you see demographic shifts going on like Bucks. And, you know, so Bucks is going from a red to a purple county, right? In certain parts of the Bucks County, it's clearly blue. So that's what's all in part getting worked out here, which is why it's so important to have someone like Cyril there. The other thing I'm really happy about is that, you know, and this is both for talking to him kind of offline, but we talked about this in the podcast a little bit too as well, is that, like the Fitzpatrick, Mike Fitzpatrick and Brian Fitzpatrick, right? The Republican representatives from the PA First, they've been kind of treated with kid gloves by the local media, right? Like in part because they have, you know, they've created a very strong brand, and I'll just say him now because, you know, whatever, Brian Fitzpatrick created this strong brand of kind of being the kind of like, you know, the most independent congressperson, right? That's on all his billboards and all this kind of stuff. He shows himself to be very moderate. On some things, he makes really strategic decisions about, you know, say, for example, preserving farmland and kind of being kind of one of the few Republicans will actually say that, you know, we need to kind of like do things around climate change, right? So he's a good strategic politician in that terms, but there has not been media that has actually kind of really looked into, held him to task, right? It might get mentioned here and there, but it's been fairly absent. And Cyril is, that's not going to happen with him, right? So just like any politician or anything that's going on in the town, he's going to be looking at that and digging into kind of our elected officials, right? He, like me, is of the belief that, you know, you have to stand for something. You actually have to kind of make a case. You have to run against this. It's not okay just to kind of say, all right, well, he's a less bad Republican, so maybe we should just kind of like go ahead and support him, right? Because we knew what happened last time, right? Is that when the support from some major organizations, including labor organizations, got behind Fitzpatrick, the money to get out the, you know, to get out the vote and everything like that disappeared, right? Because, you know, the money, okay, well, we're not going to go up against the union, so all the Democratic money went away. And that can't happen, right? If you can have any understanding about having power politics in the, like in Washington, D.C., from our representatives, then you have to be able to fight the battles here in our backyard. So it's awesome to have him there. And, you know, and paying attention to stuff that you can see the impact. This kind of goes back to something Sean mentioned at the top of the show, is like, see the impact of these kind of big structural things happening at the local level. His latest column just came out, and it was hysterical social media mob targets Doylestown businesswoman, right? And, you know, basically, let me just tell you a little bit about this story, because I think it's, you know, this is, I just love this kind of reporting, and I just think this is so important to pay attention to. So this woman, her name is Donna Gouldy, right? She owns this shop called Laura Gifts and Home Decor in Doylestown, right? And she was just like, wanted to do something like to thank like frontline workers, essential workers, and anybody who's been at high risk or something like this, and some kind of recognition, you know, because people came out and they supported her, you know, through online sales, but she wanted to say something great. So she did a little thing. She just said, hey, look, if you come in and you show me your COVID vax card, right, you get 10% off any like in purchase, you know, store, like in store purchase on any Saturday. Right, just kind of like, you know, random nice thing, right? But apparently she made a mistake, right? She made a mistake by saying this. She said, quote, I do understand there's a lot of controversy behind the vaccine, and I understand there are some who aren't eligible yet or some who don't want it, and that's okay, I don't pass judgment, right? That was it. But that was enough to let the freaking, like, you know, dogs of hell out of the cages, right? So suddenly she found that there were, like, she's getting, like, calls at home, threatening calls, saying that, you know, one commenter to her webpage said that, you know, those vaccine cards are the mark of the beast, right? You know, this is what we saw in these kind of right-wing circles, right? We saw
this is also the misinformation that, like, the Republicans in Harrisburg have been spreading
exactly. Right. There were others saying that if they show the card, it's a violation of their HIPAA rights, which is it had nothing to do with HIPAA rights. You're the individual. You do what you want to do. Right. It's absolutely outstanding. And, you know, these kind of things, like, this is where kind of like the rubber hits the road, right? Where the Republican Party at the national level and the statewide level have been playing with fire with these kind of conspiracy nuts for so long, right? And this is how it's manifesting itself. I mean, it's no longer just something that's happening in Harrisburg or happening in these particular locations. I mean, you have a shop owner who's trying to do something nice is suddenly kind of like targeted with these protests. I mean, who are the freaking protests, right? Because she's trying to do something nice for folks. Right. I mean, she got compared. I mean, again, this is not going to come as a surprise if people aren't following this, but, you know, she was being compared to a Nazi. She had one screaming caller. Right. She called her up and called her a communist. Right. And basically threatened to bring a group of unmasked people to her store. Right. You know, I mean, this is crazy. You know, I mean, and, you know, the good thing is that, you know, she's also received a kind of tremendous amount of support from the community, basically saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. We don't do this. So, you know, this is the kind of the small thing. So I just wanted to give that an extra special shout out for Cyril's column this week. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes today, but to, you know, also to kind of show that, you know, this is where we need to be fighting our battles, right? This is why we need local media. This is why we need progressive media on the ground. Cyril and I had a good, great conversation after the podcast too, as well, about talking about ways of kind of even coordinating and kind of, you know, doing signal boosts to kind of other progressive media sites in there. And what's been really like fantastic, I think I mentioned this on the show before, is in part once his column came out and once he and I reconnected up and started kind of like, you know, sharing stuff online, suddenly I'm starting to get connected up with a bunch of these other kind of, you know, more locally based progressive media sites, which is phenomenal. And so I look at kind of like, you know, organizations or podcasts that are kind of just getting launched, right? Like the Sisters of the Night podcast, for example. Podcasts that I see, there's this called the Connor O Show, kind of based out of Doylestown, right? This kind of young guy based out of there, and other progressive podcasts around the state. I mean, this is an amazing opportunity we have to actually build out a kind of a network where we're doing kind of mutual aid, right? You're kind of doing the signal boost for each other, because our model obviously has to be a different model than you've got what happened in the right-wing media. We don't have the billionaire backers that are going to sink in and kind of like fund us. I certainly, nobody's come knocking at my door as long as I've been doing Raging Chicken, right? And offered to give me any kind of help, right? Nobody's been saying, hey, listen, we're going to help support the show. We're going to help kind of go here because we believe in building out the progressive media infrastructure. It doesn't happen. And if you talk to other people, you talk to Rick Smith, you talk to other people who have attempted to do this, right? By maintaining like a independent media, progressive media voice that is accountable to the progressive community, right? And the members of that stuff, right? Not to some kind of like, you know, billionaire donor, but to other members of the community, right? We can't rely upon, you know, the showers from above, right? We have to rely upon each other. And, you know, I've got some, one of the things if people remember, I talked to Paris Marks back in, I think it was December, and he's a guy who hosts the Tech Won't Save Us podcast. And he's a Canadian, right? He's part of, his podcast is also joined up with this network of progressive podcasts across the country. And it's housed in an institute that's located at a university, right? And that's kind of the whole idea about building this network of mutual aid, which is, I find very, very intriguing. So I've reached out to some of those folks up in Canada too, as well, just asked them a little bit about, you know, what they did and what kind of suggestions they would have to building out something like that. So again, these are long-term, big range kind of ideas and plans, what becomes possible. But little things like this, like, you know, Cyril getting that column. And then you can see the kind of the launch of I'll just keep on talking about the amazing folks that are running the Sisters of the Night podcast. You see these things kind of coming up. There's a real opportunity here, to build a lasting infrastructure. So, kudos to Cyril, and please do check out his latest column. So that's pretty cool. One last thing I wanted to mention before we kind of go to break. I mentioned this briefly kind of in the lead up here today. You remember, we've been following what's happening in the Pennsylvania state system of higher education. As you know, that I teach at Kutztown University, so I'm a member of it. I'm an interested party. But there are the Chancellor McDreamy, Chancellor Greenstein of PASHE, has been pushing these mergers of six universities into two. So Lock Haven University, Bloomsburg University, and Mansfield University are being forced into one. They're, you know, coming up with some sort of corporatized name for them. And then it's, I think it's Clarion University, California University, and Edinburgh University out on the western side. And it'll be like whatever, some corporatized name out there. Right. And what Greenstein has been doing has been, every time he's meeting with donors, every time he's meeting with politicians, every time he has an opportunity to talk about this stuff publicly, he's done this at town halls that I've been on. He'll say that he talks to faculty, he talks to students, and they're all excited about these mergers, right? Now, if you are a faculty member or you are a student, you have reason to question that as being even kind of a legitimate statement. And you ask, how does he base that on? He's like, oh, conversations I have with people. Well, he claims to be the data guy. So you know what happened? The faculty union, ABSCUF, decided to say, you know what? We're actually going to gather the data. So we're going to go out and we're actually going to survey our members, right, who are part of those schools that are being merged. And so a total of 991 faculty members basically reached out and talked to or were surveyed to ask about how they feel about the merger and what they think about it. And, 70% of the faculty members at those universities said, no, this is a bad idea, right? Only 2% of students said that they were excited. How about that? So where Greenstein is getting this, this just shows you the kind of like disingenuous communication that this guy does. And he says that we're being so transparent. Number one complaint about this process of merger and what is happening at the States of Higher Education now is the complete lack of transparency and the centralized decision making in the hands of Daniel Greenstein. So we'll be following this. He was actually out. He did a special thing out in Berkeley yesterday. That he went out there to champion and say like how great it was and how happy people were about the mergers, right? And again, one period, big period lie, period. So good work and kudos to ABSCUF for getting that survey together and then kind of getting it out into the media and letting that circulate, basically to call bullshit on Chancellor Greenstein's moves and saying how excited everybody is about these mergers. So just wanted to plug that before we headed out. Anyway, Sean, anything else before we go to break?
No, that's it. That's everything I got.
All right, man. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We're going to go to break right now. We'll be back right now for this week's quick last call. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting, and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back, everybody. This is this week's last call. Beer news, space news, whatever else we want to talk about. I'm going to keep this relatively short today. Just got a couple kind of cool things. We might see a major event kind of going on this week, at least in my world. NASA's Ingenuity helicopter, right? That's that little helicopter that was tucked underneath the Perseverance rover that landed on Mars recently. That was first, it was released from the rover, and the rover kind of like rolled away and took a picture of it, right? And there was actually, I should say this too as well, there was kind of independently a volunteer, someone on social media basically took 66 of the photographs that were taken by the Perseverance rover after dropping the Ingenuity helicopter, and basically was able to piece them together and do all this kind of photoshopping to make it look like, you know, a selfie shot with the Perseverance rover with the Ingenuity rover, who they're calling Ginny now. That was just cool. But anyways, they went through the first round of tests. And again, this is the old helicopter, first time it's ever been tried. It had to, you know, survive a couple nights out in the freezing Martian temperatures to see if it was actually going to be able to withstand that. It survived that successfully. Its solar panels are working. Just yesterday, it kind of opened up its rotors, right? Its helicopter rotors, and kind of did a kind of little bit of a test of them to see if they're kind of like, you know, responding, and they were. They were going to do some a couple of tests coming up about first spinning at a slow speed and then spinning it at a higher speed ahead of any potential flight. And they're saying that the flight could come as soon as Monday, sometime after this Sunday. So pretty cool stuff going on in Mars. And so check that out this week. There's also, I believe, that there's a new crew that is going to the space station this week too as well. I think there might be a launch on Sunday. I think the Soyuz is going out today, but that's a whole other thing. Anyways, the other thing I just wanted to kind of mention, I am totally psyched about going to the 2021 Mars Society Virtual Convention this fall. I checked in on parts of it last year when they had it, and because Elon Musk was on and things like this. And this guy, Robert Zubrin, who's basically, you know, it's this kind of independent, all-volunteer organization. There's space advocacy stuff. I love listening to this guy and listening to these people, because they are on this kind of like libertarian kind of fringy kind of end of things. But it's also this uneasy pairing with some scientists and some other stuff, and then people like Elon Musk, obviously. So I'm totally looking forward to kind of getting this. I have to say, you know, there's an academic portion of it too, as well, as that I think I'm working on this class on. It's going to do space rhetorics. It's going to look at space policies and kind of ideologies and things like this around this thing. So I'll be able to kind of look at that as a researcher too as well. And hopefully I'll be reporting back on with Rage and Chico. That's not happening until October, so that's a long ways off. It will be virtual. I'm not going anywhere. So that'll be cool. And do check that out. It's pretty fun. yeah. Anything else you got going on, Sean?
Nothing too much. I'm just waiting for my computer to get here. straight from the sweatshop factory's hands.
There you go.
You know, it's really funny. We're talking about Dr. Snell's class. You know, I actually wrote about Apple in that class. And then, like, I looked at my computer, the order today, and it's coming from Shanghai. So it's probably coming from, like, you know, the mega factory that, you know, I wrote about while I was in college, you know, so full circle there.
How do you feel about that, Sean?
Gotta hate the game, not the player.
There you go.
but it's like, we were talking about this, like, this is what this is what our lives are like because of globalization, because of the race to the bottom. And yep. It's just like, you know, I have a computer that's dying and I don't have, there's no American companies that make computers, or that companies that are based in America with their factories that make computers and that pay like fair living. So,
I'm not like a major computer person, right? I was never a gamer, for example. You know, I mean, I played video games, but I'm not like a gamer. But the last two computers I bought have been, kind of basically gaming computers that have been put together in the United States. I mean, again, it's not a solution, right? Because still all those parts, all the boards and everything like this, a lot of that stuff, if not all of it, is still produced elsewhere. But, you know, the idea is like, you know, that's all we have left, right? I mean, kind of smaller shops that are actually assembling computers because everything is being produced elsewhere.
Yeah. But, I'm definitely looking forward to getting my new computer in.
How did the Instacart go today, by the way?
Good. I'm just still waiting for it to get here. looking forward to, I got some nice photos of the Capitol in bloom this week. Looking forward to that. Definitely. I love my new, my 35 millimeter lens, you know, like that's a shot with the daffodils and stuff like that.
Yeah. You did some great stuff this week.
I'm having a lot of fun with that, new lens. So I'm looking forward to using it some more. And, just waiting for some more crazy shit that's going to be coming up. We got some news coming up probably in the next week or so. So keep an eye out for that. It's going to be fun. It's been something we've been working on for months now. And it's finally come to fruition, which is a great feeling.
Yeah.
Just getting ready for crazy shit to start happening again with the weather getting warmer. There's a bunch of rallies and all coming up over the next several weeks. So gonna have some fun.
There we have it. Well, fantastic.
Yeah, I can't wait to get my second shot in a couple weeks too.
Yeah, Tuesday. I get my second one on Tuesday.
Nice.
I am very, very excited.
My second one will be on the 26th. So look forward to that. We'll all be fully vaccinated by the time we go on vacation this summer, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And, looking forward to it. And I guess I should say my sister, she passed her exit exams.
Woo! Congrats to her.
For her nursing school. I think like 60% of the class failed, which is like kind of like it shows you how hard those courses are. And she got hired at the hospital she was working at for the past year doing her clinicals. And it's a unionized hospital, so she'll be a union member there too.
Awesome.
Yeah. Hopefully she starts learning about solidarity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what the union movement is.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. You know, who knows? Maybe we'll actually have her on the podcast in a few years when she organizes, you know, when she becomes a kind of an organizer at her workplace.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I have to work on her with that. Like,
yeah, I'm just saying.
It is closed. It's a closed shop, but I don't think she understands the value and the importance of unions. So, you know, got to tell her that. She knows what I do with working in the labor movement and stuff like that. So,
yeah. Well,
don't be a scab.
There you go.
Rule number one.
You don't want that. I do think that is like the first step. The first step is don't scab. Right. I mean, the first step is kind of like if you get to that level of consciousness, like, I mean, seriously, it's like that's the first thing, you know, you're on the team. You're not the individual. Right. And if you're an individual who wants to kind of like say, screw the rest of the team, then, you know, you're not going to be my friend. So let's leave it at that.
Family member.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, no, she's a family member. So, you know, you got that. I have cousins who are kind of like super conservative, right wing and things like this. But when it comes to the union, like they're not going to cross the line ever. Right. So at the very least, we got that. Right.
Yeah.
So great. So I just want to give a good shout out. Forgot to mention about stuff about Free Will. Free Will's got a bunch. I don't think they have any new releases this week, but last week was like the mother load of releases that they put out, which we were not here for, actually. So if you go check them out at freewillbrewing.store, you check out their cans. They've got one. It's called Breakfast Epiphanies. That looks phenomenal. It's a bourbon barrel aged imperial stout with coffee and maple sugar. That comes in at 13.7 ABV. That is also the little cans, the 8.4 ounce cans, because it is pretty potent. You've got Chatter Pie. This is a dark mild. This is the first time that they've ever done a mild ale, and it's brewed with a base of Maris Otter plus a touch of crystal malt, pale chocolate, and midnight wheat, hopped ever so gently with Pilgrim and East Kent Goldings, carbonated to a lower level to mimic the idea of a traditional cask pull. And that comes in at a nice kind of sweet 4.3 ABV. It's been the return of the cloudy with a chance of charcuterie. Did I get that close that time, Sean?
Charcuterie, yes.
Charcuterie, yeah, I can never say that.
I had some charcuterie this morning for breakfast.
Oh, there you go. Fantastic. Well, the cloudy is a...
cheese.
What's that?
Super satin cheese.
Oh, nice. Well, cloudy is one of their great, great beers. It's got a great new can design and things like that. You can check that out. That's in four packs. That's an IPA with Citra, Mosaic, and Apollo coming in at 7% ABV. And the last one I'll highlight for us today, they have the latest mash that they put out. This might have been even 2 weeks ago, but it is it's called the Sweet Cherry Vanilla Mash, and that is a sour ale, a sweet cherry, vanilla, milk, sugar, and it comes in at 7.5 ABV. Great stuff. You're looking for something, you want to spend some time outside, you're kind of in the area, you want to check them out, head on over. You can go to freewillbrewing.store. You can order online, go pick it up at the store. You can have them waiting for you. They'll send you the kind of information on the app. And if you are kind of like, you know, far afield, you're nowhere near it, but you want to get yourself some Free Will, You can always kind of order online. They'll ship anywhere in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. If you hit that $85 mark, you get free shipping too as well. Obviously, you got to be 21 years old, so there you have it. Anyways, that's all I got, Sean. Anything else for the good of the order?
No, that's pretty much it.
All right, man. I am going to go out. I'm going to dig in the dirt today. I cannot freaking wait. The garden is
doing this well. Rain?
Is it raining?
It's raining out in Harrisburg.
Oh, I don't know if it's raining. I'm in the basement, so this is like where I spend all my time, so I don't know these things.
With your blanket, with your blankie.
It is. It's freaking freezing in my basement. I'm like, we don't have the air on or anything like that, but it's freaking freezing, so... Anyways, I'm an old man. All right, man. Hey, good talking to Sean. And this has been Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Thank you all for tuning in. Sorry for the technical glitches that we had a little bit today, but it's the nature of the beast in our COVID times. We'll see you on Monday. Ideally, we'll be here with Chad Nicholson. We'll be here next Friday. Got some great stuff coming up. See ya!